Let's go. Today's sponsorship is kindly appreciated and is Le'ilui Nishmas, Nishmais Brana Bas Bendit and Zelig Ben Kalman. Again, grateful for that sponsorship for the whole year. Now, today is your Hanukkah special. We have a very interesting topic, which we have not talked about in this vein before, but I want to look at Hanukkah as, in many ways, the enlightenment and the coming of age of Torah Sheba'al Peh. And there is a strong light theme going through this, which we'll see. It is related to the Greeks, and it's many ways the Greek system of thought contributed to this change, this shift. Sometimes this is known as the Axial Age, that a lot of societies around this time, around, let's say, 300, 400 BCE, took a shift in mindset from something that was more related to voices, if you like, coming from divine sources, Lahavdil, in our case from Nevuah, in other religions from wherever they felt they were hearing their voices from, a shift from that to a more internal focus. In case of the Greeks, it was philosophy. Lahavdil, in case of Torah Sheba'al Peh, it was more a sense of rabbinic analysis, and we'll see where this is coming from. But Hanukkah is very much a celebration of that reality, and we'll see how that comes out. It's an idea that's not often emphasized on Hanukkah, but I want to bring it out today. So let's start with a Masorah of Torah Sheba'al Peh, and we'll see how this relates. Number one. So this ties together Mishnah and history and Masorah all in one. Pirkei Avos opens with the Masorah, the chain of Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law. Moshe Kibbal Torah Misinai. I'm not getting into now why Moshe received it from Sinai, as opposed to from God at Sinai. That's another shear. Umasra, the process of Masorah, he passed it on. Le'Yoshua. Okay, with more about Yoshua soon. V'Yoshua le'Zakenim, from Yeshua to the elders. He doesn't specify who the elders were, but they're often identified with the Shoftim, the period between Joshua and Shmuel HaNavi. V'Zakenim le'Nevi'im. And somehow the Nevi'im were also part of this, and that's going to throw open a big question. What was their role? We know who the Nevi'im were. Let's start with Shmuel HaNavi and move through from Shmuel all the way through, Nevi'im Acharonim and Trei Asar to Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, who were the last, as we'll see soon. What role did they play? Unevi'im Masruha le'Anshei Knesset Hagdola. And the Nevi'im passed that on to the men of the Great Assembly. The Anshei Knesset Hagdola lived in towards the beginning, just after the beginning of the Second Temple period. And we'll see how that works in a minute in terms of Hanukkah. And then, of course, Pirkei Avos goes into what they said and special things we remember from them, which I'm not looking at right now. And then we see Shimon HaTzadik, Hayami Shiyarei Knesset HaGedolah. Shimon HaTzadik was the last of the Knesset HaGedolah. And he passed it on to Antigonus Ish Socho Kibbol Mishimon HaTzadik. And Antigonus from Socho on to Shimon HaTzadik. Yosef ben Yoezer Ish Shreid of Yosef ben Yochanan Ish Yerushalayim. Then we have a period of the pairs where it was two major figures, which the Gemara identifies as the Av Bet Din and the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin and the prince, president of the community. They received from Shimon HaTzadik. They were the two Yoseis, Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer and Yoshei ben Yochanan. And then in number 9, I've put the little numbers in to help there. Yoshua ben Parachia v'Nitzar Arbeli kiblu mehem. Next generation was Yoshua ben Parachia, Nitzar ha'Arbeli from Arbel. If you know the Galil, the mountain, the Arbel, looking over just north of Tveria, that's where he lived. And then Yehuda ben Tabai v'Shimon ben Shetach kiblu mehem. That was the next generation. Shimaya v'Avtalion kiblu mehem. And finally Hillel v'Shamai kiblu mehem. And that was the end of the Zugot. Excuse me. From Hillel and Shammai, of course, there's a very big spread of Torah Sheba'al Peh to Beis Hillel, to Beis Shammai, and then to all of the names that we know and love, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and Rabbi Akiva, and all his Talmidim, etc., etc., etc. Now, that chain of Masorah plugs into the Hanukkah story in a very specific way. I brought you in at the bottom of the page a little a picture there, a little family tree of the Hasmonean dynasty, of Mattathiahu, the head of that dynasty, and the five sons that you know, going down through the generations to Yochanan Hyrcanus, who was the first, not king, but the sort of moved into more of a royal direction. And then, of course, Alexander Yanai, who did proclaim himself the king, and his wife Shlomtzion Hamalka, one of the famous queens of Israel, Salome Alexandra, their sons Aristobulus and Hyrcanus had the civil war that the Hasmonaim were then fighting each other, which led to the invitation of Pompey from, who was of course a general, together with Julius Caesar. Pompey comes into Israel in order to solve the civil war, and then will not leave, and then you end up with the last of the Hasmonaim, Miriam, who married King Herod, who of course was not from the family of the Hasmonaim, but was an Idumean, he was an Edomi, and he came in as a quasi-Jew, if you like, married the last of the Hasmonaim, killed all of the Hasmonaim he could find, including his own wife, including his own children, and anyone else he could identify, and that was the end, as they say, of that. Now, how do those two chains fit together? Just go over the page for a second, and you'll see a few correspondences which are important. So Moshe, Yeshua, Zakenim, and Nevi'im we'll come back to in a minute. The Anshei Knesset Gedolah was, as far as we can see, sometime around the 4th century BCE, after the time of Ezra. The Anshei Knesset Gedolah was a great Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was classically 71. We get that from the Chumash, when Moshe Rabbeinu in Parashat Bahalotcha says to God, I can't deal with these people on my own. Please give me a team that I can use together with them. So God says, take 70 elders, so you get 70 plus 1, is 71. The Anshei Knesset Gedolah was a great Sanhedrin of 120, which I assume was 121, which gradually, Rav Ruvi Margolis says, they appointed this as a super Sanhedrin to kickstart the process of the Second Temple, Torah Shabbat Peh, we'll get to in a minute. And as they died off, they did not replace them until they got back down to 71 again, and then they continued from there as a Sanhedrin. But the Greek era that we're interested in starts really from Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik, who you remember was the last or one of the last of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, with him is the famous Midrashic story, is it also a historical story, maybe so, about him meeting Alexander the Great, wearing his big day kahuna, remember there's a whole Gemara, and inviting Alexander into Yerushalayim without having to conquer it. That is a historical fact. There was no conquest by the Greeks of Yerushalayim. They came in peaceably. And the story, of course, after that is that, yeah, all the Jews who had sons called their sons Alexander in honor of Alexander the Great. And to this day, Alexander is indeed a Jewish name. My grandmother's maiden name was Zander, or Sender, which is also from Alexander, and that is a known fact. And as you go through the next few generations, you then get the Hanukkah story together with them. So if you look here, Yosef ben Yoezer and Yosef ben Yochanan was the beginning of Hellenization, that period just after the Sadducees had also come in, and the Hanukkah story happens, the Hasmonaim dynasty, in the time of Yeshua ben Parachia and Nitai Ha'arbeli. Now, interestingly, and as a side issue, the Gemara associates Yeshu Hanotzri, which we might translate as Jesus of Nazareth or might not, as a Talmud of Yeshua ben Parachia, clearly and explicitly, which puts Yeshu Hanotzri in the Hanukkah story somewhere, which of course historically is not where the Christians say Jesus lived. And the question then is this the same one? Are there lots of people called Yeshu? Yeshu was a very common Second Temple name, short for Yeshua. Who was this man? Was it indeed the Christian Jesus or not? Were there multiple Jesuses? You can speak to lots of people about that. You get different answers. But I'm just throwing that in as one of the interesting side questions. It's related to also the missing years in the calendar, maybe. There are 160-something years that should be in the Jewish calendar that are missing, mid-Second Temple period. Is that connected with this Yeshu HaNotri story? Rav Sadigon thinks yes, others think no. That's a whole shir in itself, which we actually have. If you remember, maybe it's time for that shir again, where the missing years, but that's not for today. The Jewish civil war between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus was in the time of Shammai Vartalion, and King Herod was in Hillel and Shammai. So just putting those together is quite helpful and important, I think, that we understand that the Masorah proceeds together with the historical stories of the Hasmonaim and the Greeks and into the time of the Romans. Now, my focus for today is on Torah Shabbat Peh. So what I'm going to do quite quickly is just draw your attention to some of the sources in part B, but not to all of them. We actually had a longer share on this about 2 years ago. It's on the website. You can find it there. But I just want to bring your attention to the fact that Nevuah, There is a major difference between the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu and the Nevuah of later Nevi'im. And the Rambam makes a lot of this and talks about the fact that picks up on the Gemara, if you're just looking at number 4, Kol HaNevi'im Nistaklu Ba'as Baklaria She'enu Me'ira. All of the Nevi'im, other than Moshe, saw through an occluded lens, through a foggy lens. But Moshe Rabbeinu Nistakel Ba'as Baklaria HaMe'ira. Moshe saw through a transparent lens, a clear lens. Meaning, and the Rambam picks up on this very clearly and says, that's because only Moshe Rabbeinu was able to transmit halacha. For halacha, you need an aspaklaria me'ira. He could give us mitzvot. That's why Moshe says, ze hadavar. This is the thing. Pointing to this exactly, there's a clarity to it. Whereas all later Nevi'im use the language ko amar Hashem. Like this. Meaning the Nevi'im later saw images, saw pictures, and put in their own words, transmitted and translated, the ideas that God was giving them. That's not clear enough, says the Rambam, to base Torah on. You can't have halakha based on this aspeklaria she'ena me'ira, only an aspeklaria me'ira. But that itself is a major debate, which I want to bring to you now. If you look, please, on page 3. And again, we will go through some of the later sources in more depth. But I brought you a whole package so you can look at this later in your own time. Some Chanukah Shabbos, Chanukah reading. Have a look here. The Rambam is very, very clear. Number 9. Veda. You must know this totally clearly. Shehanavua lo to'il bi'iyun b'peirushi ha-Torah. Nevuah is never acceptable. It does not work in transmitting and explaining Torah, ulemidat hadinim yud gimel midat, or in darshaning, the process of drash, where the rabbis interpret and pull out ideas from the psukim. It never works through nevuah. Elamash sheyase Yeshua or Pinchas, whatever Yeshua and Pinchas did, beinyanei ha'ion in terms of their analysis of Torah, the hadin and the halachic system, humash sheyase Ravinu v'Rav Ashi. That is what the later Amoraim did in their analysis of Gemara. The Rambam repeats this again in his Hakdama to the Mishnah, number 10. And he says very basically, very clearly, that whenever it refers to the Nevi'im, they wore two hats. Either they wore a Navi hat, which is receiving from on high inspiration, this Aspaklara She'enu Me'ira. But if you were to go to Yeshayahu HaNavi and ask them a Shaila, you know, I've just dropped, I don't know, milk in my beef stew. I was going to say chicken soup, but of course, at that point, chicken was still parav, but that's not for now. I've just dropped milk in my beef stew. What should I do? Says the Rambam, if Yeshayahu HaNavi turned around and said, hang on, let me go into prophetic mode and ask God what he feels, Navi Sheker, Chayev Misa, that Navi has to be killed because you may not do that. What the Navi has to do, says the Rambam, is take off his Navi hat, put on his rabbi hat and say, okay, I'm offline. We're working offline now. And we're working through Ion just like the later rabbis in the time of the Gemara did. That's how I'm going to analyze your question. A Navi could never utilize their Nevuah to answer halachic questions. You have to have these two things completely separated. And that's why, by the way, later authorities talk about the idea of Eliyahu HaNavi and Eliyahu HaTishbi being two different modes of Eliyahu. For example, when the Gemara has a Shaila in Metzias, a Shaila in a question of a fact, it says, don't worry, Techake, actually, it's just not Techake, what does it say? Tinechat Sheyavo Eliyahu. Let it wait until Eliyahu comes. Meaning, I found lost property, I don't know who it belongs to, but it's got a simon on it, I just can't find them. Let it rest until Eliyahu comes, because Eliyahu will use a prophet hat and will tell you, Yehimunach, that's the lesson, Yehimunach ad sheyavo Eliyahu. Whereas when the Gemara says, Teiku is on halachic question, so the Tosfos Yontzev and others later say that's just short for Tishbi, Yitareitz Kushus for Abayas. The Tishbi will come and resolve your halachic questions. Why the Tishbi? Why not Eliyahu? Because Eliyahu is not allowed to. Eliyahu has to wear his Navi hat for Eliyahu, questions of fact, and his Tishbi hat for questions of law. That's the Rambam's view, very clearly. However, the Kuzari does not take that position. The Kuzari takes the position the Nevuah was very much part of the halachic process. I'm not going to read the whole Kuzari number 11, but let's take a shortcut and go over to number 12 and pick up with Rav Kook. Looking at number 12. Rav Kook will summarize for us. Again, you should look at source of the Kuzari on your own. Says Rav Kook very clearly, in case we had any doubt, Shitat HaKuzari, the view of the Kuzari, he shehanavua v'ruach hakodesh messiah lahora'a. Very explicit. The Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration and indeed prophecy, are of assistance in Psak, deloy kedivrei HaRambam. Unlike the Rambam, Shemachalkam, who splits them, and never the twain shall meet. And therefore, Rav Kook wants to point out that there is built into this question a debate. Was Nevuah a halachic mechanism, or was Nevuah a lot? The Rambam says clearly yes. The Kuzari says clearly yes. And one of the proofs that Rav Kook brings, if you look in 15, look again in Rav Kook, Moshe kibbel Torah misinai u'masar Yeshua of Yeshua's came as leNeviim. We saw that in Pirkei Avos. Says Rav Kook in number 16, the doichek, it's a bit kvetched. I think the best English word for doichek is kvetched. It's a bit kvetched, lomar shirak b'mikre haita masoret al yidei Neviim. It says in Pirkei Avos, the Neviim were part of the chain. Oh, it was Neviim wearing a non-Navi hat. Really?
Why call them Neviim?
To say they were the Zakenim, the elders, the Sanhedrin. It's very hard to say that really there was no Nevuah involved. There was Nevuah involved. And this is not just Rav Kook and the Kuzari. Rav Tzadok HaKohen, who we're going to pick up on and look at quite a lot right now as we get into Hanukkah, clearly takes that view. Look at number 17. All the days of the prophets. There was no need to obey the sages, which is actually very interesting. Where were the Sanhedrin in the first temple times? In the second temple times, we see them all the time. The interaction between the Chashmonaim and the Zakenim and the rabbis. Why don't we see when we open Malachim Aleph and Shmuel Bet, why don't we see the Sanhedrin as players? We see the king, we see the Kohanim, we see the Neviim, they're big players. But not so much the rabbis, a little bit, but not so much. Where were they? Or in other words, if I were to transport back in time to the Shabbos table of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, what would that look like? What did halacha look like during the first temple period? I know what it looked like during the second temple period. If I were to go back in time to the Shabbos table of Hillel HaZakeh, it would look pretty like Shabbos does today. Shammai even. It's not like Shammai was so different, but David HaMelech, Chizkiyahu HaMelech, so says the Rav Tzadok, there was no need to obey the sages. It seemed likely that even though it's true that there is no place for prophecy as far as the study and knowledge of the Torah, he wants to kind of point to the Rambam, as he says, Lo b'shamayim hi. That's an important point. It's not in heaven. This applies to the knowledge of laws of the Torah and its general rules. But there's ample room for knowledge acquired by means of prophecy as far as the details of performance of any particular time. As Maimonides describes at length in his introduction to come to the Mishnah, as a temporary expedient, the prophet had the power to suspend the commandments of the Torah. It's interesting. Rav Tzadok wants to try and make shalom. He wants to say that even though the Rambam said that you can't use your Nevuah, that's just for the big picture items. Surely for the details, the Neviim were part of people's day-to-day life. Maybe you'd have, if you had a Shiloh at the time of the first temple, says Rav Tzadok, you go to your sister-in-law, who's a Neviah down the road, it's always good to have a family Neviah, and you'd ask her your Shilohs, or your brother-in-law who's a Navi, or anyone like that. That is perfectly reasonable. That's why the sages themselves were less central. Number 18, it goes without saying, says Rav Tzadok, that in doubtful instances, the people and the sages were required to obey the prophet. And many prophets arose in Israel to command actions in particular situations. Therefore, the general leadership of these generations was in the hands of the prophets, who were the leaders of these generations as far as the affairs of each generation were concerned. Rav Tzadok HaKohen is a very interesting figure. If people are more not familiar with him, Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin was a misnagid who turned chassid. Which is a good combination in my personal view, because he has all the analysis and rigorous approach of the Litvaks, as it were. But then he had an encounter with the Ishbitzer, as a famous Shalasudas, that they made him come against his better judgment to the Shalasudas of the Ishbitzer. He stood at the back of the room while the Ishbitzer gave a drosha Shalasudas time, and he starts screaming. The story goes, the Ishbitzer's got into my head, I can't get him out of my mind, and he becomes a chassid of the Ishbitzer Rebbe, and he himself becomes one of the major Hasidic thinkers of the mid to late 19th century, Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, and he is particularly interested in this transition phase. So that's the position that he's given us so far. Even though the Rambam says Nevuah, no, he says, but yes, it's in the details, maybe yes. Yeah.
Most of the prophets lived in the times of the kings as well.
Yes, he did.
So you mean from a halachic point of view, they were
yes, the yes, 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 correct. So you have them together with the Kohanim and the Nevi'im and the kings, etc., etc. Now, our interest is the end of prophecy. Who are the last prophets? So the Gemara says number 19. Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, Sof, Nevi'im, Hei. They were basically the end of the prophets. After that, we are officially a non-prophet organization. Okay, the identification of Malachi with Mordechai is also interesting. That's thrown in by the Gemara. Maybe Mordechai was part of that process as well. But our interest is really at the very end there. In number, you look on this of number 5. There is a quote from Seder Olam Rabbah. Look at Seder Olam Rabbah. Seder Olam Rabbah gives an exact time period. Even though the end of the prophets was Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, when were they? They were at the beginning of the second temple period, where the Jews had returned, and Zechariah is saying, surely this is the end of the 70 years of exile, it's time to rebuild. And if you remember, there were a number of false starts. First of all, Zerubbabel ben Shaltiel came to try and start things off, and it did not succeed. The Yishuv did not take off. But later on, when Ezra came and then Nehemiah came, eventually they built the second temple and they moved that forward. Says Seder Olam Rabbah. What's Seder Olam Rabbah? Seder Olam Rabbah is a work of history / Medrash by Chazal, attributed to Rabbi Yosei, who was living in the time of Rabbi Akiva, one of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. So he says in number 22 the following. Quotes from Daniel. Daniel is a very important book. Middle Second Temple, exactly when you date Daniel is an academic and scholarly question as well. Let's assume middle to the late Second Temple, somewhere around then. But certainly Seder Olam quotes it, the Amad Melech Gibor, there will be a great king who arises, Umashal Mimshal Rav, and he will reign extremely strongly, Uva Asakir Tzano, and he'll be able to do whatever he wants. Who is that great king that Daniel is prophesying? Says Seder Olam Rabbah, who Alexandrus Makedon. This is Alexander of Macedonia, Shemalach Yud Bet Shana, and he ruled over the Near East there for 12 years. Ad kan hayu hanaviim mitnabim beruach hakodesh. Up until that point of Alexander, the Nevi'im had ruach hakodesh. Mikan ve'elech, from that point onwards, then it says, quotes in Mishlei, hat aznecha, then put your ear, incline your ear, ushma divrei chachamim. That was the turnover. When Alexander came, that was the official end of Nevuah. There was no more Nevuah at all. And Hanukkah, therefore, comes after a time of Nevuah. If you look just at the source before 22:21, this is a fascinating Midrashic idea as well about Purim. Purim, of course, is at the beginning of this transition. You have this transitional period from the beginning of the Second Temple through to Hanukkah. Purim is at the start. Hanukkah is at the end. Look what the Gemara says in number 21. Lamanatzich, lamanatzich ala yelet hashachar. Now you'll know this. This is a Tehillim that we say. Tehillim that we say on Purim. Who was a yelet hashachar? Amar Rabbi Yasi. Lama nimshla Esther l'shachar. Why was Esther like the morning? And of course, there's a strong link, Astarte, the idea of phosphorus, the morning star, Esther and Astarte, the whole idea of that, that there was a pagan side, of course, which Esther gave the Jewish angle on. Amar Rav Asi, Lama Nimshala Esther LeShachar, Loi Melecha, this tells you the following. Ma Shachar Soif Kol HaLaila, just like Shachar is the end of the night, which is, as far as I can see, a positive comparison, a positive metaphor. Darkness is coming to an end. Af Esther Sof Kol HaNisim. So too Esther is the end of all miracles. Which sounds like a good thing, no? That's the end of the night. The night miracles is a time of darkness. Baruch Hashem, we're reaching the end of that dark period. It's the end of miracles. Ah, v'ha'ika Chanukah. What about Chanukah? Chanukah is also a miracle. No, nitna lichtovka amrinan. We're talking about the miracles of Torah shebichtav. That's what came to an end with Esther. Esther is the end of the written Torah. Chanukah is already a different kind of a miracle. And again, this presumably is talking about the Pach HaShemen, but also maybe talking about the military victory, which is also the miracle. One of the big questions that Beis Yosef poses about Chanukah is, why is Chanukah 8 days, not 7 days? Because the nace lasted for 7 days, because there was enough oil for 1 day, so why on earth are we lighting for 8 days? We should be lighting for 7 days, and there are hundreds and hundreds of answers to that question, one of which is that the 1 day of Chanukah is the miracle of the victory, and the other 7 days is the miracle of the oil. Of course, there's another question, is why isn't Chanukah 9 days? Because why don't we add on an extra day in Chutz La'aretz? That's a different question, which is not for now. Okay, fine. So Esther is the end of darkness, the beginning of a new dawn, literally. And that means the end of miracles and the beginning of a period of Chochmah. Let's have a look at how that works. There is a very famous Midrashic idea that when the Jewish people received the Torah, they had to be forced to accept it. Let's remind ourselves of the Gemara, number 23, Shabbos Peches, Ve'isyatzu b'tachtis ahar, they stood under the mountain, Amar Rav Avdimi Barchama Barchasa, Melamish Shekafa HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleihem Har Kegigis. This very famous, God held the mountain as it were over their heads, Ve'amar Lehem Im Atam Mekablim HaTorah Mutif. If you want to accept the Torah, great. Im Lav Sham Teik Roskam. This is where you'll be buried if you don't accept it. That is the way the Torah was given. Amar Rava, Rava says, Afal Pike, nevertheless, Hadur Kibluha Bime Achashverosh. Here she is again, Esther, Achashverosh, in the time of Achashverosh, the people really accepted it, as it says, Kimu Vekiblu HaYehudim. Kimu Vekiblu HaYehudim, and you can't tell from the way it's written here, but it's also written in the singular. It looks like one person accepted it, like the singular it's used there for Vayichan, that they camped at the mountain. Kimu Mashe Kiblu Kfar. Purim somehow is a new Kabbalat HaTorah. How so? And also, there's a built-in question. Don't we talk about Naaseh V'Nishma? Naaseh V'Nishma, the people accepted the Torah willingly, more than willingly. So why are they having the mountain held over their heads? Either they're willing or they're not willing. If they're willing, then great. If they're not willing, then these two things don't go together. But they do. Because the Midrash says in number 24, we'll see how this works. The Midrash brings this idea. God had to force them, as it were, to accept the Torah. Forcing doesn't obviously mean coercion. It's the sense of how could they not accept the Torah? Having gone through Yitziat Mitzrayim, the miracles, the Exodus, the Kriyas Yamsuf, the Amar of Dimi Bar Chama, Amar of Kodesh Baruch Hu Yisrael, Im Kablam Atem Es HaTorah, Mutav Ve'im Lav Sham Tiyek Varaschem. This is the same idea. Ah, says the Medrash. Ve'im Toima Ala Torah Shebichtav Kafa Aleim Es HaHar Kegiges. So maybe for Torah Shebichtav, they were forced to do it. V'haloi Misha She'amah Lahen Mekablim Atem Es HaTorah Anu Kulam V'amah Nasa V'Nishma. You can't say that about the written Torah, because they said Nasa V'Nishma. Because written Torah is easy compared to oral Torah. Tsar hima'at. There's not very much pain in learning Chumash. Everybody loves to learn Chumash. I mean, it's quite a small book. Think about it. You can fit it in your top pocket. Compare learning Chumash to learning Gemara, learning Daf Yomi. When it comes to Chumash, the Jewish people said, oh yeah, we'll take that. Naaseh V'Nishma. Sounds great. When it comes to Torah Shebaal Peh, are you serious? We have to do all that work? We have to do Daf Yomi for 7.5 years? And that's only skimming along the surface. How could we're not taking that? But the rabbi, the God said to the Jewish people on Torah Shebaal Peh, "Sheyesh ba dikduke mitzvahs kalus." There are such tiny details, kalus v'chamuras v'hi azakam kamaves. It's like death learning Torah Shebaal Peh. It's very hard. V'kasha k'sheol. It's like hell. Going through it. It can be extremely taxing. Because the only way you can learn Torah Shebaal Peh is if you really love HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As it says, etc. That's what they had to be forced to do. Because who's going to volunteer to do that? And that's what they accepted upon themselves later at the time of Purim. So it's Torah Shebichtav versus Torah Shebaal Peh. And that's why, says Rav Tzadik HaKohen, looking at number 25, this is a key source for us, Hatchalat Torah Shebaal Peh, the beginning of the oral law, he bebayit sheni me'anshei Knesset HaGedolah. That sounds like a very radical statement. Oh, what happened to Pirkei Avos? There's a Masorah. Yes, there's a Masorah, and we'll get down to the breakdown of how that works, but that's on a small part of oral law, which is received, if you like, halacha l'Moshe Mi'Sinai. A Masorah coming down, and even the expression halacha l'Moshe Mi'Sinai doesn't always mean dafka, that it came from Sinai. The Rosh says it just means it's a very old tradition, but the real nitty-gritty of Torah Shebaal Peh, that takes so much time and takes so much brain power, that starts with the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. Shehei Miyastei Habayis, who also founded the Second Temple. Hei Miyastu Gam Kein Torah Shebaal Peh. They founded the Oral Law, Kama Sha'amri B'Yerushalmi Shkalim, and he says in Yerushalmi, Dibimei Mordechai Ki Muma Shekiblu Kfar. He puts the dots together and he says, this is what they did. Shechazru L'Kabel HaTorah Mi'Ahava. He's clearly channeling this Midrash. Through love, they decided to accept Torah. Shalaya al yidei kfias harka gigis, without being coerced to do, az zaku lakach. That's when they rose to this level. Ki ika hakfias har haya Torah Shebaal Peh, because their coercion at the beginning was on the oral law. Kamosha amru batan chuma, and he quotes the Midrash. The kolz man shaloi kiblu amiritzonam, all the time that they were being forced, if you like, to take the Torah. Loi nimsra adayin lahem lagamri, it wasn't really given over to them. V'hayu mitnagim alpi neviim, Hakol b'chsav miyad Hashem. That's why they use Nevi'im. Rav Tzadok HaKohen is giving you a very fascinating and somewhat radical new reading of Jewish history. And let me just summarize it. He's saying the following. God gives the Jewish people a package. He says, okay, here's Torah, written Torah, oral Torah. The Jewish people say, written Torah, na'aseh v'nishma. Oral Torah, no way. And God says to them, I'm really sorry, it's a package. Mountain over their heads, you've got to take it. Okay, to put it like that, we'll take it. But they kvetched and they didn't want it. And that's why I skipped over some of the earlier sources. When Moshe Rabbeinu died, as long as Moshe was alive, it was fine. Why? Because they can just go to Moshe and ask a question. He's online 24/7. Yoshua, the Gemara's in Tamura, which we skipped, you can go back over them. They say to Yoshua, okay, we don't know the answer. You go and ask God. He says, that's not how it works. I'm not Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is compared to the sun. Yoshua is compared to the moon. Which means I'm only reflecting that light. I'm not online, I'm offline. You've got to work it out for yourselves. Says the people wanted to kill him. Until God says, okay, you know, we'll still spoon feed you. Shmuel HaNavi. The Gemara also says in Tamura there. They wanted Shmuel HaNavi. You go and ask. Go and ask the answers. Shmuel says, no, that's not how it works. And the Jewish people wanted to kill him as well. It's never been a good job being the leader of the Jewish people. It's difficult. Okay? Eventually, says Rav Tzadok, God, as it were, gives in. Remember what it says at the beginning of Shmuel? There wasn't much prophecy. It was yakar. It was very precious and rare up to the time of Shmuel. But from the time of Shmuel, boom, then you have prophets almost without number. What's happening here, says Rav Tzadok, is God is basically giving in to the, as it were, childish approach of the young Jewish people. Oh, you've got, just tell us what to do. And God said, you know something? I wanted you to accept the responsibility. You can't do it? Okay, so here's 500 years of prophecy. Go and listen to them. Eventually, when prophecy ceases, along come the Greeks. Alexander the Great, a people like the Greeks who say, we can work it out for ourselves. The Jewish people then say, ah, okay, so if you can work it out for yourselves, then we can also accept the responsibility, not just to work it out entirely for ourselves, but to have Torah Shebichtav, which are the red lines, but also Torah Shebaal Peh. So Rav Tzadok HaKohen's understanding is that the whole issue of Hanukkah is the coming of age of the Jewish people to actually put in the work, and that's why Nevuah ends, and that's why it happens when the Greeks come, and the whole thing ties together. The autonomy of Torah Shebaal Peh, of generating those ideas from inside the human, together with Torah Shebichtav, that is exactly what's going on in Hanukkah. And Hanukkah is dafka used exactly as the paradigm. Look in number 26. When the Gemara asks the question, how can we say a bracha v'tzivanu on a rabbinic mitzvah? It's a classic question. How can you say God commanded us to light Shabbos candles? It was a rabbinic mitzvah. So look in number 76. It uses Hanukkah. Amar Rav Chiya Bar Ashi, Amar Rav. Hamadlik nesh el Hanukkah tzarech levarech. If you light a Hanukkah candle, what do you break? Brocha do you make? Ma'am varech. Baruch Hashem, kiddushanu, mitzvetzav, vetzivanu, lahadlik nesh el Hanukkah. Says the Gemara, v'heichan sivanu, how can you say, where were we commanded? Where does God say light Hanukkah candles? 1,000 years after the Torah was given. Rav Avia Amar Miloy Sasser, the mitzvah of Loy Sasser, the mitzvah in the Torah not to deviate from the words of the rabbis. Rav Nechemia Amar, Rav Nechemia says, Shal Avicha V'yagetcha Zekeinecha V'yomru Lach, which actually Rav Kook differentiates and says that there's a slightly different emphasis. Rav Kook says the latter one is more on a Masorah, Shal Avicha V'yagetcha Zekeinecha, there's your parents and grandparents as a Masorah of Torah Shebaal Peh, but the Loy Sasser is really the focus on the issue of the rabbi's authority. The authority of Loy Sasser, of the rabbis, to create new mitzvahs d'rabbanan. And this is really what is beginning in the Second Temple period. If you look on page 6, I brought you some sources that, again, I'm not going to look at in detail. Yes?
Why the rabbanim were allowed to do that?
Because they were always allowed to do that. But Rav Sorek is saying that now that they were prepared to do that now. Why? Because there was a shift from a Torah coming min hashamayim to Torah coming from inside the person as well. The ability and the responsibility to create Torah from the human mind together with Torah Shebichtav, that was something the Jewish people and the whole world were only able to do from this time period. And it's actually very interesting if you look, who writes about this? Kugel, professor, what's his name? James Kugel, writes about this in terms of the Axial Age. And he says that this all over the world, people were going through this transition at this point. You can look at the Chinese, you can look at the Greeks, you can look all over the world, and at this certain point in time, people suddenly decided, you know something? We have to actually generate truth to some degree from inside ourselves as well. For us, this is the dream team of Torah Shebichtav coming from the outside and Torah Shebaal Peh coming from the inside. It's a combination.
Basically, a reaction to the fact that Nevuah ended. Once Nevuah ended, there was no choice. Rabbanim had no choice.
Well, it depends which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Right.
Meaning, are you going to turn around and say, Nevuah ended, so the people said, what can we do?
We now
have no choice. God's taken away the crutch, as it were.
Exactly.
Chazal actually don't understand it that way. Chazal connects the idea of the Second Temple, the rabbis davened to take away the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah. And there's this whole midrashic idea of a lion roaring coming out of the base of the Kodesh Kedoshim. In a sense, Avodah Zarah is the flip side of Nevuah. It's receiving truth from some divine detached source without you actually processing it. And they said, okay, we don't want that anymore. We want that to come to an end. So maybe that itself triggers the end of Nevuah. You can't have both. It's a combination package. So when they ask for Avodah Zarah to be gone, then that's the end of Nevuah as well. So did one trigger the other, or did the other trigger the one? Of course, this also brings with it a darker side, which is Machlokas. When you're having Nevi'im, well, there's nothing to talk about, is there? You ask your Navi, your answer comes down from on high. Look at number 31 for a second. Yosef ben Yo'ezer Omer Shaloi Lismoich. Yosef ben Yochanan Omer Lismoch. This is quite a famous, again, in Chagiga, the machlokas about smicha, which is, do you have to put the hands on the head of a korban when you bring a korban on Yom Tov? Now, by the time of the Second Temple, Yom Tov already had laws of muksa, which prevented your interaction with the animal. So on the one hand, the rabbis are telling you not to use the animal, because it's muksa. On the other hand, the rabbis are telling you you need to do smicha on the korban. So how do you need to? Oh, that's a Torah mitzvah. So one of the Yosis said to do smicha, not to do smicha. But Yosef ben Yochanan Omar Lismach. Then the next generation, Yeshua ben Parachia Omer Shelo Lismach. Nita Arbele Omer Lismach. The next generation also a debate. Yes or no? Yehuda ben Tamai Omer Shelo Lismach. Shimon ben Shatach Omer Lismach. The next generation, the same debate. Shemaya Omer Lismach. Shemaya says the next generation do smicha on the animal. Avtalion Omer Shelo Lismach. Why can't they work this out? Why is this debate reverberating through the generations? Hillel and Menachem loy nechleku. Hillel and Menachem didn't disagree. Oh, Baruch Hashem. Finally you have Achdus. Who's Menachem? Who's Menachem? And then the Gemara very agnatically says, Yatsa Menachem. Menachem had to leave. Exactly, the story of Menachem is a very interesting one of the skeletons in the cupboard from the end of the second temple period. He went a bit off. He ended up in with Herod, big mate of Herod, and he basically left the Sanhedrin for political life under the Romans, not getting into that now. And they brought in a replacement, Venichna Shammai, and then the normal service resumed. Shammai Omer Shaloi Lismach, Vehillel Omer Lismach. And then they had a machlokus again. Okay, and Rashi says here a very interesting thing. Says Rashi, "V'zohi machlokas rishona shehaisa b'chachmei Yisrael." This was the first machlokas of the Jewish rabbis. This was the first machlokas. All the way through the first temple, they didn't have any machlokas. Open up the Chumash; every page is machlokas. Korach, Dasan va'avira. Of course, there was machlokas. This was the first time there was machlokas that they could not resolve in the normal way. This rap machlokas ran on and on and on because you're in a new paradigm now. It's not the same paradigm as before. Now, the Rambam reads this a bit differently. The Rambam says, well, this is the point at which the Sanhedrin ceased to function properly. But it was always the Sanhedrin, not Nevi'im. But Rav Tzadok will say, no, up until this point, it was the Nevi'im. But this is exactly the point that Nevuah stops. This is the Hanukkah story. So at this point, the Jewish people had to work it out for themselves. And if they can't work it out for themselves, then that's a major problem. And that's why it goes all the way through the generations. Let's have a look now just a little bit before we finish in the last 15 minutes at rabbinic law and see how this kind of all wraps together. Because we haven't really focused on this for a long time. As I mentioned to you before, the Sanhedrin was always a presence, even though it maybe wasn't as central, says Rav Tzadok, to the Jewish people. But the Sanhedrin dates all the way from Bamidbar. This is the Pasha, the Pasuk in Baaloscha that I mentioned before, in number 32, where Moshe says, please give me someone to help me out. And God creates the 70 Zekanim, or brings the 70 Zekanim as an idea. And they have a Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was with them through the first and second temple period, and then eventually moved to Yavna, as you know, after the second temple was destroyed, from Yavna to Usha, and then from Usha to Yavna, and then back to Usha, and then eventually it was in the Galil, Bet Sha'arim. I think I've mentioned this before. Bet Sha'arim is a fantastic site to visit. Up in the north, it was the seat of the Sanhedrin. My wife and I once drove past this on our travels in the north. We saw a little brown sign saying Bet Sha'arim this way. I thought it was going to be another pile of rocks in the ground that said, you know, someone was here a long time ago. And I couldn't have been more wrong. It's a United Nations World Heritage Site. You have the necropolis of all of the Sanhedrin buried there on the ground, and you have the layout of where the Sanhedrin sat in Bet Sha'arim. It's absolutely remarkable. I strongly recommend that you go up there, and eventually in Tveria, where the Sanhedrin was abolished by the Christians, the Byzantines, who killed the last Nasi and abolished the Sanhedrin. That's why there's a tradition the Sanhedrin will reconvene in Tveria, and that's one of the reasons why the Rambam wished to be buried in Tveria, but that's, I'm not getting into that right now. Now, so the Sanhedrin we've had for a long time. Lo Sasor we've had for a long time. This mitzvah that the Gemara and the Midrash and later the Rambam quotes is in number 33. Look at this briefly. Ki yipale mimcha davar, if something yidavar lemishpat, if something is not clear to you in judgment, ben dam ladam, ben din ladin, ben nega lanega. Whatever kind of debate or suffix or doubt it is. And the Vilna Gaon compares dam la dam, din la din, nega la nega to all the different kinds of halachic debate you could have. Mutter versus osser, permitted, prohibited. Kosher versus posel, valid, invalid. And tame versus tahor, pure, impure. If you have a debate, divrei rivois b'sha'arecha, and there is an argument in your shar. The shar is where the local bet din sat. Your three, the bet din of three people, three men. So you get up and you go to a place, the place that God will choose. Come to the judges that are there in your days. And seek from them the answers. And they will tell you, as Divrei Dvar Mishpat, they'll tell you the answer. You must do what they say to you from that place that God chooses. Ushmata lasos kechala shirucha, and guard whatever they tell you. And here are the mitzvahs. Al pi haTorah asher yirucha va'al hamishpat asher yomrucha ta'ase. Do, positive mitzvah, what they tell you to do, what the rabbis determine, the Sanhedrin determine from that place. Loy sasar min hadavar asher yigidu lecha miyom min hasmal, and do not deviate from whatever they say to the right or to the left. This is the root Torah mitzvah that underpins all rabbinic mitzvah. Just like the Gemara said, why do we light Hanukkah candles and say Vitzivanu? Because God commanded us to listen to Loi Sasa. There is even an opinion in the Yerushalmi that we do not follow, that on every rabbinic mitzvah, you make the same brocha. Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvah sav Vitzivanu. I don't remember the exact terms tonight. Lishma l'chachamim, to listen to the rabbis. Because really, every rabbinic mitzvah, no matter what it is the same mitzvah, which is to listen to the rabbis, which is a Torah mitzvah. Now, we don't pass it like that with Yerushalmi. We give each mitzvah, lahadlik nesh al Shabbat, lahadlik nesh al Chanukah, lifrosh trumas and truma mina, you know, the trumas and maizes, etc. But that idea of rabbinic mitzvahs being based in Loi Sasser is fundamental. And you'd be surprised how few people know this. Many of my students assume that we have to listen to the rabbis because the rabbis told us to listen to the rabbis. Well, there's something rather circular in that argument. And they kind of know that. And the answer is because it's wrong. We have to listen to the rabbis because the Torah says to listen to the rabbis. Now the question, of course, then is which rabbis? And that is a very major debate, which I do not have time for today. We had a few shirim on Das Torah. Does this authority extend beyond Chazal? Rambam says no. Chazal, the Sanhedrin, and the rabbis of the Gemara are the end of Loi Sasser. After Loi Sasser, no rabbi has this authority. The authority the rabbis have today, says the Rambam, is maybe it's the issue of following the majority, or maybe it's the issue of you asked a shaila, so you're bound by the question, by the answer. But no rabbi can come along today and say, I am your rabbi. You can always respond, no thank you, I'm going to ask a shaila to somebody else. But the Gemara and the Sanhedrin, you can't respond that, they are your rabbis. The Sefer HaChinuch disagrees with the Rambam. Uncharacteristically, the Sefer HaChinuch normally agrees with the Rambam. But on this he says, no, the rabbis who are the G'dolei Hador in every generation have the authority of Loi Sasser. And the Shulchan Aruch HaRav paskens that way. Or is it the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch? I think it's the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch actually. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch paskens that way, that this is the authority of all the rabbis in each generation, which opens up a very interesting question. If the rabbis, first of all, you have to define who are the G'dolei Hador? And it's not just, you don't get appointed as that. The people decide in each community who they are. Do they or do they not have the authority of Loi Sasser? And I think I mentioned this before. I remember many years ago, an election in Israel, probably 9 or 10 elections ago, it was at least 10, 12 years ago, where the Yated Ne'eman, the night before the election, had a picture of Rav Eliashiv on the front page, and in the biggest font imaginable in a newspaper, two words, Lo Tasur. Meaning you have a mitzvah doraisa to vote the way that Rav Eliashiv says you have to vote. And whatever it was in those days. And that makes perfect sense within the context of the Chinuch, etc., the Loi Sasser passes. There's no question Rav Eliashiv was one of the G'dolei Hador, certainly for his community. And therefore, maybe that is indeed a Torah mitzvah. The Rambam would say, no, that's not the case. Maybe you should vote that way, but you don't have to. At least it's not Loi Sasser. But that's an interesting debate. But anyway, that is the underpinning mitzvah to listen to the Chachamim. And I wanted to bring to your attention, because we haven't spoken about this for a long time, the Rambam divides all the oral law into 5 categories. Look at this briefly, because it's good to know. Says the Rambam number 34. Nimsa lefi aklalim sheik damenu. Based on the principles we've seen, shekol adinim akfuim batorin nechlokim lechamesh chamisha chalokim. There are 5 types of oral law. Chelek arishon is perushim mekubalim mimosha, which he says is basically the explanation of the text for that generation that was given and onwards. Meaning, the text says, sit in a sukkah. So what's a sukkah? A sukkah is this. Eat matzah. A matzah is this. Shake a pre-Eitz Hadar. The pre-Eitz Hadar is this. That's just the user guide, the manual, if you like, to how to use the Chumash, but not later interpretation. That's already from the beginning. The difference between the second and the first category is just whether it's connected with the text or not. The first category, says the Rambam, is explanations of the text from Moshe on downwards. The second category is things which are not connected with the text but still come from Sinai and down. But then 3, 4, and 5 are all later. Hachelik HaShlishi, Says the Rambam elsewhere, this is the biggest of all five categories, which is rabbinic interpretation. Rabbinic interpretation of the psukim, drash, the idea of investigating and analyzing the psukim, which really begins at the beginning of the second, or the middle of the second temple. This is the Chanukah restart, if you like, of the rabbis engaging themselves in drash and producing the authority that they're from their authority of Lo Sasser, producing new halacha. And that's why when you open the Gemara, you never see debates between, Shmuel and David. You see debates between the rabbis from the Anshei Knesset HaGedola and onwards, because that is exactly when drash started in its real sense, and that's exactly what Rav Tzadok HaKohen said. That was really the beginning of the foundation of Torah Shebaal Peh as we know it. And the fourth and the fifth category, says the Rambam, is rabbinic law. Meaning the third category is not rabbinic in the sense that it's based in the psukim. Kabed es avicha ve'et imecha is darshan, to mean not just your father and your mother, but your stepfather and your stepmother. Every page of Gemara is full of drash. Drash is coming out of the text. Categories 4 and 5 are purely rabbinic. For example, like Hanukkah candles, a purely rabbinic mitzvah. It's not coming out of a posik, it's coming out of the rabbis saying that we think you should do this, either in terms of a gezerah, which is number 4, which is a more of a fence in order to protect the Torah itself. For example, muksa is a classic example. Don't pick up a pen on Shabbos in case you come to write. And the fifth category is takanot, which is positive, proactive institutions of the rabbis to enhance Torah life. I brought you, if you're interested, on page 8, I brought you some examples. And you could list thousands and thousands of examples. But just in terms of how old this is, I brought you the Gezeiros. We'll come to the age in a minute. I brought you some examples of Gezeiros, classic examples of safeguard fences to protect the Torah, which the rabbis made, and you can look at those in your own time. And I brought you examples of takanot. We often don't think of takanot, rabbinic institutions that they made in order to enhance our life, not just in ritual matters, but in family matters, in national issues, Hanukkah, like I said, fast days, in society generally. Prosbul, we talked about at length. Bans on gambling, definitions of theft, interesting halachas like a woman cannot remarry until her child is 2. That you could list these, ad infinitum. The mitzvah to make a bracha. When you pick up a bar of chocolate, say shahakol. That is a rabbinic takana, which says the Rambam is based on the authority of Lo Sasser. Now I brought you towards the end of the sheet, and I'll bring these to your attention now. The Mevor Talmud, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, basically says an interesting thing. The Maritz Chayes says that many of the rabbinic laws that we find on the books are completely unanimous. There's not even any debate about them. Which shows you, he says, that they date already from the time of the Sanhedrin, when there was no debate and dispute. After the Sanhedrin ceased to function, of course there's ongoing debate and dispute, because there's absolutely no one can resolve it. And I brought you here, just on the bottom of the page, just in Hilchos Shabbos alone, 9 or 10 rabbinic mitzvahs, which there's absolute unanimity on. That we have to light candles, that there's such a thing as muksa, that you can't have a wedding on Shabbos, that you can't swim on Shabbos, that you have to make kiddush on wine, that you can't wrap certain food on Shabbos. This is just in Hilchos Shabbos. The idea that we often, the trope that we often make, oh, the rabbis, everything's a machlokas. It's not really true, actually. Because there's a kind of bias in favor of the debate or dispute. You don't think about what is not disputed. I mean, take lighting candles. Everybody agrees there's a rabbinic mitzvah to light candles. Everybody agrees you have to light them on Friday afternoon. What do they disagree about? Can you use this kind of oil? Can you use these kind of wicks? I mean, the kind of things that most other religions really couldn't care less about. You tell a Christian to light a candle, they just light a candle. They're happy, they light a candle. They don't say, well, with this kind of wick, with this kind of oil, with this kind of... You know, you tell a Jew to light a candle, you have a whole peric of Bamei Madlikin. And of course, for us, it's important, because we don't want to light the kind of candle that is going to go flicker on Shabbos, and etc. But don't miss the forest for the trees, if you like. Don't say, well, there's machlokas about everything. It actually isn't machlokas about so many things, simply because they are very old and they come already from the time of the Sanhedrin. Okay, the last 2 points and then we'll finish. We started just a touch late. If you just look on page 9, and we'll finish with, I think, 2 or 3 very important Very, very important sources. First of all, why? Why do we need a whole autonomous rabbinic side? Just tell us what to do. God, tell us all the rabbinic laws as well. Don't just tell us the 613 mitzvahs. Tell us all the rabbinic details. We want to hear it from God. Jewish people have problems with rabbis. It's interesting. Christian atheists have problems with God. Jewish atheists usually have problems with rabbis. They don't have so much problems with God. Okay, he's a different kind of atheist. But the Ramchal comes along and says, no, that the whole point is really Torah and rabbinic mitzvahs are effectively the same. It's just that one of them God wanted us to partner with him. Look at this, number 39. Kol ha-takonos ha-elu, all the rabbinic decrees, says the Ramchal. God agrees that you have to treat them basically like Torah mitzvahs. They should really be given by God. Who is Barach Shemo? He should have commanded them. But Torah Atzma, with the Torah itself. Ele Shahaya Haratzon Lefanav Sheyavo Hadavar Mitzideinu. There has to be a partnership. And that's what the Jewish people didn't want at first. That's why they had to have the mountain held over their heads. That's why they said, oh, just get a prophet to tell me what to do. I don't want to take responsibility. Says God, no, I want you to take responsibility. That has to come from you. It has to be a partnership, not just a dictatorship. And that's why I want to finish with 41. 41 is a beautiful midrash, which I think we have to take home with us for Hanukkah. It's very much part of, I think, the message of Hanukkah. Number 41. Pam achas haiti mahalech baderech. I was once walking on the road, it says in Eliyahu Zuta. Umatsati Adam Echad, I found, Matsani Adam Echad, I found a fellow who bar labored every minis, and he came with a heretical claim. The Yeshbo Mikra, he believed in the Chumash, the Einbo Mishnah, but he didn't believe in the rabbinic law. He didn't believe in the Torah Shabbat Peh. Amali, Mikra Nitin Lanu Mehasina, he says the Torah was given at Sinai. Mishnah Loi Nitin Lanu Mehasina, but the Mishnah I don't trust, it was made by the rabbis. The Amartilai, and I said to him the following, Bini, Baloi Mikra Mishnah Lifneim Mipik Vurav Amar, no, everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but how? Umma Bein Mikra La Mishnah, what is the difference between Mikra and Mishnah? Marshal Amarshal, let me give you a marshal. A king had two servants, and he loved them very, very much. He gave them each a gift, a bag of wheat and a bundle of flax. And what did he do? He said to them, I'm going to pick them up in a couple of weeks. What did the clever one do? He took the flax, made it into linen, made a beautiful tablecloth. And he took the wheat and made it into beautiful flour. And he crushed it and he ground it. Birira, the takna, the lasha, the afa, and he processed it and he baked it and he kneaded it, etc. For sidra agabe shulchan, he put all these pastries out on the tablecloth. He put the tablecloth on, and he left them for the king to come. Hatipish, the foolish servant, he kept in his cupboard a bag of wheat and a bundle of flax, because that's what the king gave me. So the king came to visit, and said, Benai, my sons, give me what I gave you. Show me. One of them gave him a smorgasbord of pastries on beautiful cloth. The echad haitzi is a chitin bakupa, and one of them brought out nebach, a bag of wheat, the aguda shel pishtan, and a bundle of flax. Oila la oisa busha, what a disgrace! Oila la oisa chlima, what a disaster for this person! Havi oibe emehim chavi, which one is more beautiful, more precious to the king? Zaisi is a shulchan ve es pasasol. The answer to this is very clear. The answer to this is Torah is given to us to grind, to crush, to knead, to bake, to reprocess, obviously using the raw materials that we got in Torah, Bichtav to Bichtav. But we have to do that. That's what's going on here. It's not a coincidence that Purim and Hanukkah, which are the foundations of Torah Shabbat Peh, are typified by wine and by oil. And I leave you with this thought. Every single fruit which grows on the tree, when the human being processes it, downgrades its brocha from the fruit, Brei Pri Eitz, to Shehakol. You squeeze oranges, goes down. You squeeze lemons, it goes down. With two exceptions. When you squeeze grapes, they upgrade to Berei Pri HaGofen. And when you squeeze olives and make oil, the Gemara in Bracha says, really the Bracha should be Berei Pri HaZayit. But you can't say Berei Pri HaZayit because then it's not clear that it comes from the tree or from the olive because it's the same word. With grapes, there's a different Hebrew word for the grape and the gefen. But with olive, they're both called a zayid. So it says you can't do that. So what is the bracha on olive oil? Borei peri ha'etz. That's the bracha on olive oil. Now, we rarely drink olive oil straight. We drink it with something else. But it shows you that's the idea, and I'll leave you with this idea, that the human being actually upgrades, not downgrades, these things, because that's the comparison to Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh. And in the last few sources, you can look at them yourself, I brought you the even more radical idea that Chacham Adif Minavi, that the Chacham is even greater than the Prophet. And I'm not going through this now. There's lots of sources and a long piece of Rav Kook. There's a lot to think about here. And therefore, Hanukkah, I want to leave you with this idea that Hanukkah is really a celebration of the application of the human mind through Torah Shebich Baal Peh to Torah Shebich Tav. Together, the dream team of the red lines given by Shamayim, together with the innovation and thoughts that the Greeks were part of that inspiration, but we took it and made it into a very Jewish thing, which is Torah Shabbat. Okay, let's leave it there. Enjoy your Hanukkah, have lots of oily things, and then remember the Torah Shabbat. Okay. Sorry, we went on a little bit late, but we had a